This talk comes from www.euroleadershipresources.org. The European Leadership Forum is a bridge between local Christian leaders' needs and God's global resources. Hundreds of hours of key Christian thinking. Go to www.euroleadershipresources.org and sign up to receive details of more resources that can support your ministry.
Why don't we begin with a word of prayer, and then we can kind of talk about the relationships you have with your boards and whether or not you have boards and how effective you would rate your boards in terms of performance and so forth. That would be real helpful for me to get that perspective. Let's pray together. Father in heaven, thank you for your goodness to us. Thanks for the privilege you've given us to be here. It's such a joy to be in Chopron, such a privilege to be with so many who have committed their gifts and talents and energies to further the cause of Jesus Christ and various ministries that they represent. We're so grateful for that, and we're grateful for the opportunity to be able to participate in what it is that they're doing in the unique ways that you provide us here at the Forum. We thank you for the encouragement that we can gain from one another, the fellowship, which so often is not possible for us, just given the places where we serve. And it's just sometimes in the midst of the fact that we think we're the only ones that struggle with the issues that we do, it's just encouraging to know that there are others that fight the same battles and struggle with the same issues. Minister to us, we pray, in this hour, for it's in Christ's name we pray. Amen. Look at that, we prayed, and I mean, I tell you, it just works every time, you know. Lord, forgive those that didn't come, and well, look at me. I am just absolutely sopped. I was way down at the other end of town, and
you are blessed.
Green is a blessing. That's right. I was baptized, so. This is if you don't have a session notes on the board, I'll be curious just before we begin this. Some of you could share your board experiences. It'll be interesting. Is there anyone that serves as a board member of an organization here besides Peter? And you are, and so we have board members. And I would like to have you speak as board members when the opportunity arises, just to kind of reflect on some of the frustrations that you've experienced and so forth. And for those of you that work with boards, which would represent, you know, others of you that are here, maybe you work for a board as well as serve on a board, which is probably a dual role that you may play with different organizations. So, but what is your experience, generally speaking, with boards? Do you think on a 1 to 10 scale, if you're rating the board of your organization from a 1 to a 10 scale, as 10 is this is the most fantastic board that I've ever served on, to 1, this is the most dysfunctional board that I could have even possibly imagined. You know, where would you rate the board of your organization? Let's just go around the room, and you can pick an organization that you either serve on the board or an organization where basically you look to the board for direction.
I would say 3 or 4.
Okay.
The only board I've ever worked. I don't work on the board. I work with the board.
Right.
So we are separated, but I'm there when they have.
Okay. And do you feel like they're real helpful in giving you in direction and providing direction for the ministry?
Yes.
And fulfilling what essentially would be perceived, I suspect, as board functions? All right.
I've been in two positions. I'm in one board as a normal board member and voting rights, and another board I'm kind of accountable. But I'm a person who can put together that board. And to rate that board, I would say about 6 and 7. The biggest struggle is just to get engaged and more actively, not just to be participate and listening to me, but besides the board meetings, that they would be engaged in ministry.
How would you rate your board, Peter?
I'm very chuffed with it, really. We've come through a big transition process. We've merged two charities, and we've now got, and we have a huge sort of board which got all out of line with law and order, and, you know, it's with new charity laws that have changed. So we've now got a sort of streamlined board of actually 10 members at the moment. But I'd give them 10, I think. I'm not saying we do everything right by any means. We're in many ways amateurs at it, but they're highly able. And it's a very good. We get a tremendous buzz out of the meetings.
That's fantastic.
And it's high-level debates.
Now, let's go around and answer that question, and then I want to go back and ask some additional questions, because I think the role that you might play in engaging board members may be different from organization to organization. So I'd be curious to know exactly the process. I mean, do you have some level of control over who you invite to serve on the board and how are they approved? Is it a self-perpetuating board where basically the nominations come from the board and are approved by the board, or is there an electorate, you know, that essentially has to vote on the recommendation? So that's something to be thinking about, but let's go on. Wolfgang, tell me about your board, 1 to 10.
I work with several boards in different countries. So I would say they range from 1 to 5. Maybe.
Okay. You know, which is really rather sad. I think, you know, most of us would like to see, and again, you know, probably how we rate a board on a scale of 1 to 10 is probably reflective of what it is that we're expecting from the board. In other words, we're taking our perspective and we're adding a number to it because we're looking for more, perhaps, in your case, than what it is that you're experiencing. Yes, Victor. What we're using is a scale from one. You know, this board is pretty dysfunctional. You know, it's not really much. And 10 is that it's you know, we are really very, very active. We're really involved in moving the mission forward and providing direction for the ministry. And, you know, how would you rate it using that range from 1 to 10? 5 or 6, okay. And that's really honest. And really, there's no bad answers here. I think what I'm really trying to figure out, because I've done this exercise before, and it's really quite rare that I find many tens. You know, in fact, I think you're the first 10 that I've ever heard. There have been some that have been 8s and 9s, but by and large, you know, they're all on the, you know, 5 or below scale. And but what would you say?
I'm also on several boards, and I can arrange them probably from 1 to 6, 7, something like this. I know I was in one which I can give about page 9, but I'm not longer serving that board. So the board I am still there in between 2, 1, 2, 2, 6.
Okay.
So the best I have.
Well, and for those of you that are serving on boards that you're rating at 1 and 2, or under 5. I really want you to kind of reflect with me, because I've served on a lot of boards that I thought were probably 4 and 5, and I felt like I had something to offer. I was asked to serve on the board on the basis of the fact that there was something that I think they felt that I could offer, and something I felt that I could offer to the organization that was worthwhile. But when you're working on a 3, 4, or 5 board, eventually you become disenchanted. I mean, you're hoping for more, and you're looking for more. And finally, I just said, listen, this is really not necessarily the best use of my time. And that's unfortunate, because we're losing a lot of very, very good people in board roles because, you know, something's not happening that needs to be happening. And so I would be curious to get your impressions about how you feel about serving on those kinds of boards, and if you experience the same level of frustration that I did. John?
Well, there was one board I served on, I'd rate it about 5. There were a lot of things that could have been done more efficiently, but on the other hand, it was not completely useless. It was somewhere, you know, halfway.
Okay, so in the 5 range.
Yeah.
And are you familiar with the question enough to be able to respond to it? Right. But as you look at the board that basically is involved in your organization, rating on a 1 to 10 scale from dysfunctional to highly productive, how would you go? All right. Okay, all right, that would be fine. Board selection, how is it done in your organization? Just real quickly, I mean, do you select boards? How, or did you inherit a board and you don't know how you ever get rid of a board? I mean, do you have terms? What essentially, just give me a kind of an overview generally. And then we'll let, and if your system is different than that, then we'll allow you the opportunity. So when Momer shares his board, I will ask the question, how many have boards that would be similar in nature to that? And we'll show, make sure we've got all the waterfront covered here.
Okay, so I inherited the board.
Uh-huh.
It was the middle of their term when I came, so their term is for 4 years and my term is for 4 years. But I came in the middle of the
of the debt board when I became general secretary. But we have a possibility in a half term to change few of members. So
they're staggered terms? I mean, some of the four-year terms, they're not all up at the same time, are they, or are they?
Several of them were from the board before. So I think that half of the board stayed in the last change, and the half was new. So this is how it works. And now, after 2 years, there's also possibilities for some members to leave and to replace them with others.
Mm-hmm.
Only different positions of student representative can be changed more frequently because of the student life.
Is there a limit to the number of board members? Number one.
But now we have seven members, and me as a general secretary, and that one student representative.
Okay. So the
number should be something not more than eight. This is what's said in the
rules. Okay. And how is the board elected? Where do nominations come from? And
the nominations come mainly from the, I believe that they did it that way, a combination of former general secretary, and so he was probably with the had a conversation with the last board, and then they saw who is going to leave, how many replacements they need, and they made a list, I believe, together about some new people, and then general secretary had a conversation with them, but the assembly is one that has to say yes or no.
Who has to say yes?
Assembly. This is like members of the movement.
Okay.
But this is actually not working very, very, very well, according to the rules. So basically, this more old board decision who is going to be the new board.
Okay. So essentially, the nominations, it's self-perpetuating by virtue of the fact that the nominations come out of the board and are approved by the board and submitted to the assembly under the ideal situation, but if the assembly doesn't get together, then basically the board's vote stands?
Yeah.
Okay. And would, how many would be a similar situation than that?
That would be similar, but it's a little bit working.
Now, UK, you're under some interesting rules as it relates to boardsmanship, aren't you, with nonprofits?
Yes, and our situation is a bit sort of has been shaped by our history. In merging the two charities, we got each charity to nominate half the board. So
okay.
Five came from one and five came from the other. So we had the people who seemed to be most effective in each of the two charities. So that gives us 10. We all started at the same time. And we've got a rule that they can serve for 5 years, but then can be re-elected for a further 5 years. So we're sort of 2 or 3 years into that now. So this whole business of how we replace and renew is of critical importance to us, because we haven't given proper thought to that. We've had one person drop out so far because they've got too heavy an overload, and somebody else this last couple of weeks ago has announced that she's going to go to the AGM. So we have an AGM where we have an additional 14 members, who makes up a total of 25 members of the charity. And so they have to approve the new board or any new person who comes onto it. So we've got to produce names for the AGM to fill in the one who's going and the one who's already gone. So we really need two new people, which is a fairly sort of critical thing, trying to identify the skills we need there.
Mm-hmm. But you nominate them and they're approved by the AGM?
At the moment, we don't seem to have clear ground rules on this. At the moment, I think we nominate them. But the Charities Commission are not happy with this internal self-perpetuating of old boys' network. They want us, they think it's much better to advertise and have complete outsiders and fresh people coming in. So I'm suggesting to the board that if not this time, next time, we do advertise. And so we have a board to select.
Well, the nominations would still effectively come to the board for their...
They would still come to the board, and the board would then interview them and put them forward to
nomination.
The AGM,
right.
To the wider company who would make the decision.
Right. Which is really, kind of an ideal situation, I would suspect. I mean, getting nominations is certainly appropriate, but being able to feel those and evaluate them against the values of the organization and what it is that they can contribute to the fulfillment of the mission and so forth is really important. If you have a general election where someone is nominated and he's approved and basically submitted to a vote without that, you know, screening, you're liable to get people that are totally inconsistent with mission and basically take the or move to take the change of the direction of the organization to suit what they're...
I think if we did that, we'd probably get pastors and theologians and Charlie on the board, wouldn't be a business man there.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Okay, how many have boards that would be similar in nature to that? Is there anybody that has something that's kind of unique to those situations? What's your biggest frustration with your board? Try to think of one thing that creates your biggest frustration or your biggest frustration as a board member. And if you serve on a board and you answer to a board, in other words, you serve on a board of another organization, think about your frustration. And then if you serve, you know, at the behest of a board, you know, what would be essentially your frustration with the board in terms of the direction they might provide for you? Momir?
One frustration is that there are some members that are not seem to be very interested in their position, so I wonder why they are in the board. I mean, there are a few of them that attended, one that didn't attend any of the last four meetings, and one attended maybe one. And also, if there is any other kind of involvement, I don't see any initiative from their side of view. So. Anything has to be done, I have to contact them, then maybe something will happen. So I don't see any kind of interest. I mean, just from those few of them, but those
two main frustrations to me. Okay. Well, those are two legitimate frustrations, I think. How many would share those frustrations?
Yeah,
pretty common.
They don't understand their position and their vision of the organization.
Okay.
Just the board is one who employed me, so they employed me, and I mean, when they were looking for a general secretary, I had to talk with them and to part of the board. So for somehow I expected that they would be the one who were the most interested in the, I don't know, in the future of the organization.
So in your case, and it would be the case in a lot of boards that they really lack the leadership, you know, internally to fulfill their responsibilities. They're kind of looking to you to guide them more than you're looking to them to guide you. Would that be correct? Okay.
This is probably one of my positions on several other boards. It's regarding the positioning between executive and the board. Who will control, who will inform, who will... Some organizations wait for executive to call the board to prepare everything, and they just meeting together to say yes, okay, go on. Mm-hmm. For other organizations, the board has to control everything, and nothing happens without the board
approval. Right.
So from these two extremes, some boards are not defining their positioning, where they are at. Sometimes they intervene without knowing. So for executive, it's very difficult to know where and when the board will change the rules of the game.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. If you were to characterize your board with one word of the two that I'm going to suggest to you, how would you characterize it? Some boards are perceived as being policy boards. In other words, they set policy and they basically leave a fair degree of freedom to the leadership of the organization to implement policy and don't intervene all that much unless called upon. And then you have management or governing boards, which basically take on more of the day-to-day responsibilities and micromanage. So basically you're feeling, that maybe somebody's working behind you, you know, undoing some of the things that you're doing. So would you call your board...
third one.
Okay.
Is, mixed.
Mixed, yeah, okay. All right, so that kind of... How would you describe your board?
The first one.
Okay. Sets a policy and lets you go and run with it, and unless you really upset the apple cart, they're going to pretty much leave you alone. Peter?
Yeah, policy. Mm.
Okay.
Although I'm much more involved with the other board members in terms of what's actually happening. work quite closely with our chief executive.
I mean, most of you, I'm so glad Peter's here because Peter's the chairman of the board of the Christian UCCF in the United Kingdom. And I think there's not been a conference in Chopron that Peter's not attended. He's a physician. He's got lots of things to do besides, you know, spend his time here. But he really is actively involved in the organization. All of you are saying, oh, for a board member like that. But he is, you know, he's a very proactive board member. And I'm sure that's a blessing to Richard and the team there at UCCF.
I'm making the rules about governance and management quite separate. I never interfere with management. I fire off ideas.
Right.
Which is entirely free to just sort of shut up.
Right. Well, I'm not sure he'd say it quite that way. But
we have a lot of banter and
right.
We exchange views. And he keeps open with me and he phones me up regularly and we keep in touch. But I have to take an observing, strategic eye. Strategy observations and take them to the board,
right.
And lean on Richard about those sort of things. But management is his job.
So, governing board, policy board,
policy
Jim?
Board.
Policy.
Policy takes back into initiate ideas and they approve then ideas for what is going to be done, and then I'm accountable to the board for.
Okay.
We have a policy.
Right.
The Board of Trustees in our organization is people gathered from different Christian organizations. And the problem which I see that they gather it only twice in a year. And during half of a year, they're doing their own job. So they do not participate in our job. And one time or two times in a year, they gather it for deciding our problems. It's not effective.
Yeah.
Policy.
Some of them have way too much management. They decide what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. And that can be real frustrating, can't it?
Yeah.
Well, I've worked with boards like that, and all of a sudden you think, go home, you know. I mean, good night. I spend my day here, you know. You're working and shooting missiles from a few miles away. Okay. Okay, and you would be on more policy boards and so forth. And then there's one kind of a final question. I hope that you're finding at least some insight in all of this. But what is it that you really, if everything was perfect, okay, and not everything's perfect, of course, but if everything were perfect, what would you really want from the board? I mean, number one, do you see the value of a board, and what would the value be, and what would you really want from them?
So one thing I really want them to be interested in what we are doing, to show that this means something to them, but then also to help in some things that, for example, with their experience and with their knowledge, and they're all older than me, with something that I don't have, so that they see that, where if they see that the help is needed, to at least try to find with me some solutions, where, for example, they don't have to do the same amount of work that I do.
Okay. What would you like in an ideal world from your board? How would you like to, if you could change anything, what would it be, Peter?
Well, if some of the board members could give more time to actually taking part in organisational things. Some of them are very busy, and really their only engagement is at the board. I mean, they read all the papers, they keep up to speed, they know what the job's about, and they might attend one event during the course of the year, but some of them would very much like to be more involved, but they're just precious, their job's stopped them, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's similar. This is the biggest challenge, how to get them to be more involved, not just kind of coming and meeting, listening, and going home.
Okay, I think, you know, they're probably, you know, all of, unless you have something, you know, in addition to...
More responsible for them, for what they have, more involved in what they...
Why do you, I mean, that's a fairly common denominator here. You know, why do you think that exists? I mean, would you have a solution to that problem? I mean, why does this sense of lack of involvement exist within the...
Because of time. They're so busy with their
own responsibility that they do not have time.
It might be a lack of authority. A lack of authority.
Mm-hmm. It could be.
Or to appoint a minister or appointing a job.
Lack of ownership, maybe.
Okay. That's a good.
I don't have those problems with our board. All are very motivated, so no one is bored when.
No one is bored at the board, huh? Okay.
Yeah. So they're all very present, but they're all co-founders of our organization, so it's theirs.
They've really taken some ownership of it.
Yeah.
That's great.
One problem can be from vision. They're close. They're just in their vision, but probably they didn't have the same vision as the organization has. So this is why they are not involved themselves as much as those directly in the ministry would expect them. They are close, their vision goes quite close to the organization, but not the same.
I think it's part of their priorities oftentimes because they can't say no. I know some people who sit on two or three dozen boards.
Yeah.
And they are just everywhere trying to control everything. They cannot say no. And therefore, they do not have the time.
How many of the boards that you, of your boards here, have organized training programs for new board members coming in, orientations, and so clearly every board member is brought, it's clear to them what they're what we are expecting them as a board member. How many would have those kinds of things?
Yeah, two boards in, this is a board development strategy.
And are those boards, would you rank those boards higher?
Yeah, those are higher. One, I was in my step out, and that was the board. I've learned the idea of the board member developing, and they work closely to about 6 months before someone become board member to train him to be board member and continues this over the time they are part of the board. And they have also kind of a retreat just with the board members to reshape and renew the vision and things like this board organization. Not a business board, but just board of a vision and being part of.
Do your boards have internal organization, you know, in that somebody's responsible for this aspect of the ministry, or they chair a, perhaps a subcommittee or some kind of
a
right? And you, pardon me?
Committee for board development.
Right. Oh, so there's one for that, and they have other committees. So everybody
has
a
committee, and they have a committee for programs, and there is another one, four different committees, but one was the board development.
Okay.
And there are one or two persons from the board, and they attract other persons which were not in the board, but they were part of that committee.
Well, let's kind of look at the notes here, and I'm going to try to walk you through these. And it seems to me that, you know, I've had a lot of frustrating board experiences. You know, I walk into the boardroom and sit there, and the most training that I've received in a lot of situations is welcome to our board. God bless you as you assume this new responsibility, and then let's go on to the minutes of the day. And some of those meetings, quite frankly, I served on one board that met on a monthly basis, and I really committed to serve on this board. I made the decision. I made it very, very thoughtfully. I prayed a good deal about it. And when I made the commitment, I was serious about it, to the point where if I were someplace in the country and I had to fly back to a board meeting, then I would do that. And often I would do that, where I'd fly halfway across America, to get back to a board meeting, because I felt that if I made that commitment, that was a commitment. And some of those board meetings would go, and usually I'd have to leave the next morning, like at 6 o'clock, to get on a plane to go back where I came from. And so it was a costly relationship as well as being a tiring one. And, some of those meetings would go until 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning as they're talking about things that absolutely I had no interest whatsoever in. And I'm saying, you guys may have gotten out of your car to drive over here, and you can sleep in tomorrow morning, but I get a plane that leaves at 6 o'clock in the morning. It's a 45-minute ride to the airport, which means that I'm going to have to get up at 3:30 or so in order to be able to make that plane. And And frankly, you know, it might be good for all board members to kind of think of their responsibilities in terms of what it is that it's actually costing people, not in terms of money, but what it's costing them to participate in this exercise and to be a little bit better organized in terms of the way. I think there's a lot of activities that can happen outside the boardroom so that when the board does meet, you know, there's discussion on things that have been thought about, that have been discussed, that have been, you know, evaluated at one level by a group of people who are assembled just for that purpose. And then when it comes to the boardroom, now we're actually responding to reports that have been produced by people that have given it more study than what you possibly could do in trying to bring everybody up to speed to decide on something of which they have little or no information in order to be able to make an informed decision. And then, you know, to get involved in the details as to whether or not, you know, we should, you know, talk to a teacher about a skirt that was too low. I mean, I, you know, frankly, that's the administrator's responsibility or that's somebody else's responsibility, and I don't think something that necessarily needs to be brought at the board level. But anyway, that's getting, you know, a little ahead of myself. But
Jerry, you talk about board meetings going on a long time. Do you have a feeling about the optimum length of time a board meeting should be allowed to run?
Well, you know, I think 2.5 to 3 hours is probably the, I mean, I think, you know, if they go beyond 3 hours, if they're not really well, you know, managed, I mean, there are times when boards need to meet longer because of the nature of the material that they're discussing. But I think there's never a need to go from a board meeting until, you know, after midnight. I mean, some of the boards that I have served, you know, we've made commitments to one another that this is going to start at 7 o'clock. We're all going to be there and we're going to be ready to do business and we're going to end at 10 and if we don't finish at 10, then we'll have to come back at another time, perhaps. But, you know, the agenda's pretty tight. We follow the agenda. We follow the rules. And you know, that can, you know, that just makes all the difference in the world because it's not the time to visit. It's not the time, you know, if you want to visit, then come early. If you want to visit, you can stay later. But the reality is I have the board meetings to do board business.
And if you travel, you would fly for just only for 2 hours meeting?
These meetings never went 2 hours. That was the frustration. They'd always start at 7 and they'd usually end at 12 or 1 o'clock at night or in the morning.
Because there's a challenge if you're going to gather people from whole country and just for 2 hours, they spend maybe 5 hours to get them.
Well, I wouldn't mind that. In fact, I would have been delighted in that. I could have spent another extra hour with my wife before, you know, heading out to the next meeting. So that wouldn't have bothered me nearly as much as what it bothered me to fly all that way, to spend all that time in what I felt was fruitless activity. And so, basically, let's just kind of look at through this. You know, it seems to me that everything in ministry, including the board, it, you know, everything, you know, kind of starts at mission. And I think if I were, you know, starting at ground zero in, you know, assembling a board, and I think even, you know, as board elections come up, it might be good for the board to begin to discuss the kinds of issues that we're talking about here, is to revisit the mission of the organization. And in terms of not only what it says, because as you've heard me say before, and at the risk of being too redundant, let me just say that mission statements are a combination of clauses, all of which reflect certain aspects of what it is we've committed ourselves to do. And so, you know, our one clause, as I shared with you this morning in our session, the Habitat for Humanity board, or the Habitat for Humanity mission statement reads that we work in partnership with God and people everywhere from every walk of life, comma. But that's a whole concept. And really what they perceive themselves as being is an ecumenical ministry that seeks to engage people, you know, from every ethnic background, from a variety of religious backgrounds, and basically engage them collectively in doing something, you know, that is really intended to make a difference in the lives of people so that we work in partnership with God and people everywhere from every walk of life. To build and renovate homes, that's another whole concept that they've committed themselves to create community, which is another clause, or it's separated by a comma, because they see the value of community in really building people and building relationships, so that people can become all that God intended for them to be, which is the real focus. It's not to build houses. It's not to give somebody shelter. It's to use shelter as a means of being able to enable people to become all that God intended for them to be. And so, you know, that is the purpose of that organization. And it seems to me that at least board members need to understand that. And there ought to be ways that they can contribute to one aspect or more in a very significant way to that mission being accomplished. And so there would be some people that would be of, you know, different you know, maybe ethnic minorities or whatever, because the goal is to work with people of every, you know, so the board is reflective in some way of the constituency which it seeks to serve, so that there's someone who can really reflect honestly those opinions and so forth. And I don't think that should be, I don't think we should go for ethnic diversity for the sake of ethnic diversity. You know, sometimes, at least in America, that becomes a, you know, a huge issue. We have to have our token black, we have to have our token, you know, Hispanic, or we have to have our token whatever, you know, because it just wouldn't look right if we didn't have them. I mean, if they don't have anything to offer beyond their color, then they probably ought not to be on your board. But nonetheless, it certainly isn't wrong to look there for board leadership, because if they in fact do have the characteristics and the capacity of being able to make meaningful contributions, then they should be engaged and they should be looked at, you know, for what it is that they can bring to the board. One of the things, you know, that I spend a lot of time talking about, and we talked about this a great deal this morning in our session, is profiling. And what I mean is, you know, profile the ideal in terms of what, you know, things would look like if you were to fulfill that mission. In other words, what would the boardroom look like if, in relationship to composition, what would the partner families of the Habitat for Humanity, I mean, they certainly would reflect diversity, I would suspect, in terms of background and so forth. And the building site, you know, there are a lot of things that would essentially look different if we were totally successful in fulfilling our mission. Then, one of the exercises that I often take through people through is, if we're going to be successful in accomplishing this mission, you know, as we've articulated it and as we've thought through it in terms of the practical ramifications of it, then what groups of people out there would be critical to our ability to be able to do that? And I think this begins the process of beginning to identify, you know, where we want representation or where we might need representation in order to be able to fulfill the mission to which we've committed ourselves. There are certain groups that probably need to be represented on your board. You know, in the case of Habitat for Humanity, you might want, you know, people that are involved in local government to basically help us to be able to assess, you know, where the needs of decent housing, you know, are to be addressed and so forth. And so it would help us to understand, you know, what groups of people need to be represented. And then as we look at the board or the composition of the board, I think our understanding of its mission and the critical groups that are essential to its success will help us to identify, you know, what we would like, you know, board members to represent. What does our board need in order to be able to get done what it is that needs to get done? I think Peter made a very, very good point. I mean, you'd want to have perhaps an accountant, an attorney. You might want to have an alumnus of the UCCF, somebody that had been through the student union ministry and really can understand it, had been active as a student and is now as a professional. You might even want to have a student representative, somebody who essentially can represent what it is that's going on right now. You might want to have, I would assume that Richard serves as either an ex officio member of the board. Yeah, he comes in, but basically attends board meetings and can speak on behalf of the administration. Having a pastor on the board or a theologian on the board, you know, is certainly something that you might want, because there is, you know, obviously a need. The reason we have boards is basically because we recognize the importance of accountability. I mean, actually, a board is a great thing to have if, in fact, the board is fulfilling its responsibility, because it keeps you accountable to someone and essentially keeps the ministry accountable to them. And I think most board members don't understand the role that they play in actually facilitating the activity of business as it takes place within the context of the nonprofit. I frankly agree with, you know, and I suspect that's probably been clear in terms of remarks that have been made, at least in passing, that probably the ideal board is, in fact, a policy board that basically establishes policy that doesn't get involved in micromanagement, because they're not in a position to be able to understand all the ramifications that impact ministry. They're not in a position to be able to say, well, this ought to happen and that ought to happen. There are a lot of things that we don't know, and probably what it is we don't know is, in fact, somewhat legendary. At least that would be true in some instances. Recruiting board members, I think we ought to have a developmental profile. In other words, what are we expecting from a board member from the developmental standpoint? And so maybe the question ought to be, especially from a developmental standpoint, and I think that probably from an administrative standpoint, you might want to sit down with the primary administrator of an organization or the leadership team and said, if we had the perfect board, what would they look like? What would they be doing? How would they be engaged in the ministry? And so you have a sense in which, and then if you were to look at it from a developmental standpoint, what would you want every board member to know and to understand? Certainly you'd want them to understand that the nature of the mission of the organization. You'd certainly want them to be involved, because if we're just looking at the AID cultivation grid, the realities are their attendance and their involvement and their contributions to the organization, you know, are essential. And if anyone should model what it is that we really want people that support the organization to model, it should be board members. They ought to be leading the way, paving the way in terms of their own involvement and activity. Now, I don't find it difficult at all to sit down with board members and saying, if you're not prepared to make that commitment, then you probably should not be on this board. And I'm not suggesting that you have to give, you know, huge amounts of money. I'm not suggesting that you have to, you know, put a second mortgage on your home in order to be able to support this ministry's, you know, future plans. But if you're not prepared to donate to it, and I don't care, you know, if you, I don't, you know, the concern of what that gift might be is really, you know, incidental to me. But if you're not prepared to do it, if it means no more to you than that, then you're probably not the most ideal candidate to serve on this board. And I think, you know, we probably, I don't know what your position is in relationship to those things as a board. We can talk about that. But it seems to me that you know, being a board member ought to be an honor and not something that we have to beg somebody to do. And yet I know many organizations that they're just fighting to get people to run for the board. You know, they just can't, you know, get board members. And so they really basically do very, very strange things in order to be able to appeal to someone to serve in the capacity as a board member. Well, once you have the developmental profile and the, you know, you've identified the groups, you know, from a broader perspective of what it is that you'd like to have represented in the board, then that puts us in a position to be able to evaluate candidates in a different light. In other words, you know, you interview candidates. Well, what is it that you do? What is it you think you can bring to this board? You know, here are some of our expectations as board members. We expect you to attend meetings, and if you miss more than two meetings or three meetings in a row without some excuse, then the realities are you're automatically off the board. In fact, if that's not a policy, you probably ought to consider something like that. You know, we are expecting you to make contributions to this board. I've been invited to boards, and it's been very, very clear from the very beginning that it's expected of me as a board member to make contributions to this ministry, you know, and if I'm not prepared to do that, I probably shouldn't be on the board. But I shouldn't even consider the opportunity if, in fact, I wasn't prepared to do that. I mean, I think it's reasonable to expect that board members participate financially. So I think, you know, those things being, you know, clear and upfront is really pretty important. Cultivating relationships with board members. We've talked about attendance, involvement, and commitment or donation. But I think there are intermediate steps to a board. And I think a lot of organizations, I know a lot of organizations in our country that do that, is they have advisory boards. There are different opportunities to serve before you're actually nominated, essentially, to the governing board of the organization. So it gives you the opportunity of kind of being able to look at people and to evaluate them in settings that are less stressful than putting them on the governing board and then having to live with them for 3 years or 4 years or 5 years, you know, when we realize that they aren't performers, when really what it is we're looking for is people who are really going to roll up their sleeves and become involved in the support of the organization in ways compatible with their ability. So we recommend, and we really think that, you know, advisory boards, task forces that have short-term commitments, and yet you can engage people and watch their leadership skills and use those opportunities to be able to assess people before you actually bring them into a board role. And then seeking their involvement. I just think the involvement of board members, I know a lot of boards are basically organized on the basis of the components of their mission statement. And so there may be a subcommittee that basically works with us in student ministries, if that's an important part of what it is that we do. And so that student ministry board person who's in charge of that may work with a task force within the organization to evaluate certain aspects of what it is that you're doing. And very specific assignments on a regular basis. Let's take a look at our curriculum and what it is we're doing around the United Kingdom. And is our curriculum, you know, essentially sufficient in accomplishing some of the mission goals to which we've committed ourselves? And so we're evaluating it and looking at it, not for the purpose of, you know, making, you know, to put anybody in a difficult situation, as much as to make sure that what it is that we're serious about what it is that we're doing, and that seriousness is reflected in what it is that we're you know, we're teaching and we're making available to students who are part of the movement. And so it seems to me that every board member ought to have an assignment within the board. And I think those assignments ought to be consistent with your needs, not only as it relates to, you know, the administrative needs of the organization, finances, administration, the kinds of things that typically board members would be responsible for. But board members are also responsible for the fulfillment of the mission. And so making sure that there are responsibilities where they are really having the opportunity of really seeing what the organization is doing, assessing it and making recommendations perhaps in a more formal way as it relates to how those things could be accomplished more effectively. You know, what are the responsibilities of board members? Well, I think, you know, people have influence. And board members ought to be expected to use their influence to further the cause of the organization of which they're a part. I mean, they all know people, and certainly capturing the universe of individual board members in a way to that could further the cause of the ministry of the organization is certainly appropriate. You know, to use their influence on behalf of the organization. And I know that, you know, you have board members that do that, who basically tell the story frequently to others as it relates to the organization. The point that I make down in Roman numeral 4, creating a developmental agenda, you know, certainly is something that probably needs to be discussed. You've heard me say it before, but, you know, we oftentimes assume that, first of all, everybody that comes to the board knows what it is they're supposed to do as a board member. Well, you can't assume that because, you know, they've had varying experiences, some of which have been good and some of which have been bad. So you can't assume that they know how to be a board member, because oftentimes it's a relationship that they may not be familiar with, or basically they're assessing their experience on another board and they're just transferring all the information they have about how boards work from one situation to another, and the situation they may have come from might have been bad, and so they may just basically transfer their expectations, or at least what it is that they feel is going to be expected from them to the new board in which they're serving. And the other thing that we can't assume is we can't assume that they're going to try to figure out, you know, or take the energy to try to figure out what it is they should be doing. You could assume that they would know that they ought to use their influence. You could assume that they would know to devote their time. You could assume that you would know, or they would know, to use their giftedness to enable you to accomplish what it is that you want to get done, or that they would give their resources to help fund the projects. You would think that they would know to do that, and they're going to assume those responsibilities. You can't assume that. And I think that's true in every relationship. You can't assume that people are going to expend energy beyond what it is that they're asked to expend. And if you don't ask them, the realities are they're just going to slide through this. They're going to go from board meeting to board meeting to board meeting to board meeting and never fulfill their potential as a board member. But they have something to give, but the realities are they're not going to take the energy to try to figure out how to apply what it is that they're gifted to do into the situation that is unique to your organization. And I'm just absolutely convinced of that. I think we make too many assumptions that everybody's just going to figure it out on their own. And that just doesn't happen. I think, you know, to finish this up and then we can kind of finish our discussion, but I think that training is by and far the missing link in terms of our boards. I don't think, you know, we do a good job at board training. And I think that would be almost universal across the board with some rare exceptions. You know, where board members are actually taken through a training course. You know, here's what it means to be a board member. And they ought to, you know, be brought to their attention before they're ever voted on, because it seems to me that they ought to understand that before they're ever put up for vote, because if they're not prepared beforehand to accept those responsibilities as a board member, then they probably are not going to be a good board member. So it seems to me that you ought to, from the beginning, say, this is what it means to be a board member. We'd love for you to be a board member. We feel like you have something to offer. And tell them what it is you feel that they have to offer. You know, you have a rich background in serving nonprofits. You are an attorney. And what it is that we need is this is what it is we need as an organization. We feel like this is a perfect match. You know, to be a board member, this is what it requires. We're going to have meetings this, and, you know, here, and here, and this is how they're handled. You'll probably serve on a subcommittee the first year you're there in the area of your expertise. You will serve with someone else, you know, and you'll have the opportunity of seeing how that works or however you want to do it. But the realities are they need to be very, very clear up front what it is to be a board member. And then if you're giving them responsibilities for which they may not have the expertise to deal with, it may fall out of their area of expertise, or at least, I mean, you could have an attorney that doesn't know an awful lot about nonprofit law. And so you may assess where it is they are in relationship to what it is you want them to do, and if there's training opportunities for them to get up to speed in terms of this particular area of their responsibilities, then it seems to me that you ought to make sure that all those resources are made available to them. I train board members, you know, all the time in training programs. In fact, I really recommend when we do a training program, because we allow people in America, when they come to one of our training programs, to bring 3 or 4 people to the training session. And we recommend that they at least bring 1 board member, because we feel like the board needs to understand development. Because if the board doesn't understand development, then essentially it makes it awfully hard on the administration. And I think that's what has made UCCF work so well, is that Peter has made it his point to learn about development. So just imagine how much easier that makes it for UCCF. Because here's a board that, you know, a board chairman who understands the process of development and how it works, and so he basically can provide support. But I know that there are a lot of you, because I served on a board like this. We had a board like this when I served as a vice president for Grace College and Seminary, and there were some board members that kind of knew how development was supposed to be done, because this is the way it was done in their church, or this is the way it was done in another organization. Well, this is the way, you know, Jerry Falwell did it. Jerry Falwell is an evangelist that's pretty well known in America, and he, you know, he does it this way. And this was particular board member was, you know, a supporter of that ministry, and he just thought that was the way we were to do development. And so essentially he was using his position on the board to basically forward his agenda, which wasn't really consistent with ours. And so, trying to get people, and if you don't have a better plan, As a director of an organization, you're pretty much at their mercy, aren't you? I mean, if you don't have a plan that basically sounds any better or more convincing than their plan, essentially what you do is you follow more developmental agendas. You follow an agenda that may not be consistent in terms of in leading your organization to where it wants to go. So, you know, having everybody on the same sheet of music in terms of the goals that we're striving to reach and the means through which we attempt to reach those is really going to be pretty important in not spinning your wheels, but getting things done that your organization is committed to doing. So I think training is the missing link. We need to create an agenda for them, a developmental agenda for the board. Don't assume that they know what to do. That we should have expectations and we ought to work with them in helping us to manage what it is that we're doing from a developmental standpoint. In terms of giving, I think you've probably all heard this. Some people say the board members, and I'm not, and I really want to make one more clarifying statement before we talk about it some more. But I've heard people say, the three roles of a board member are give, get, or get off, you know. And essentially, you know, it's pretty clear. You're going to give, you're going to go out and get money based upon, who you know and the influence that you have. And if you're not prepared to do either, then you're to get off the board. Well, that seems a little harsh to me. I think probably maybe you're saying, well, gee, I'm going to write that one down. Because if you're not prepared to give or you're not prepared to get, and there's a part of me that says, well, you know, that's I think it ought to be expected for people to give and to get. I'm not sure that I'd be quite so, you know, harsh on the get off thing, but maybe that needs to be said in some instances. But in the corporate world, and oftentimes in the nonprofit world, people are selected to serve on boards, you know, on the strength of their financial statement. You know, in other words, if you're wealthy and if you're known to give 7-figure contributions, and if you have any kind of inkling whatsoever towards the ministry that we represent, then we'd sure love to have you serve on our board. And so consequently, what you end up having is a lot of people that are very, very wealthy that care never, you know, that really don't care that much about the organization, and they know they're being manipulated, and they're willing to be manipulated in order to have a position of power. And I think that's not consistent with where it is that I'm coming. I would rather have spiritual men and women who deeply love the Lord, who are deeply committed to our mission, who deeply understand what it is that we're doing, that are prepared to do, to give and to get, and to do the other things that are required of board members, than I would be to have, you know, people who basically don't share those same values, but yet have something to give that we feel is so important that we're willing to almost compromise anything in order to be able to get the money. And I think that's, you know, that's a danger that a lot of organizations find themselves, because board members who give money then have leverage that oftentimes will choose to use that to create something that isn't necessarily consistent with what it is we've committed ourselves to do. I realize it's a real problem, but I, you know, first of all, I think boards exist for our protection, and that's intentionally the way that the reasons why they were established in the first place is that there's somebody that has responsibility, and they do have fiduciary responsibilities, and I think those fiduciary responsibilities need to be clearly understood by board members coming on, that they are the ones that are basically responsible for that organization. If something were to go awry, it's not the executive director that's going to fall, you know, into hands legally for the responsibility of having done that. I mean, he may be fired, but the realities are the ultimate responsibility lies in the board, that they have the fiduciary responsibility for the management of that organization. It's not a small, it's not an incidental, it's not, and it should be something, you know, that I think eldership, as Paul says, is something that, you know, should be, you know, for those people that are called to do that kind of work, it should be something that we aspire to. But it's that job of eldership as it relates to an organization. Probably the same qualities that are reflected in the scriptures for elders ought to be reflected in board members for those organizations that we represent. You know, the same kind of character qualities that Paul talks about in 2 Timothy and in Titus as it relates to those people who take on the responsibility for leadership.
Can you recommend a book for boards?
There's a great book by John Carver, and I think probably some of you have read that book, The Carver Model for Board Leadership. And that is, if you go to, if you just type in Google or your web search instruments and put Carver and boards, then that probably has become the standard for nonprofits in our country.
Yes, but do you feel that's a model that is readily adaptable for Eastern Europe?
Well, that I don't know. See, that's the that's where I would really lean towards your wisdom and assessment. I think probably it's worth reading and probably introducing to people, and then having, you know, a group of people who essentially, you know, understand and love your organization to be able to evaluate it and to adapt it to the culture where you find yourself. But that's the one book that that I'm most familiar with, and the one that's being utilized by most of the organizations with whom we work.
Take the step lower. Do you know a more simple book where you have even basic things like setting an agenda, like, you know, planning the next meeting at the board meeting, and not going home, and then, you know, 3 months later they start phoning each other when they can meet again, and something like that.
Well, maybe I should write that book, or Peter should, or something. Maybe we got a co-author at Peter, and we could come up with it. But I can't think of. I don't know that what that book might be.
ITS has put in one book, Simple Book Administration, which is gives kind of general ideas what would look like a book for the Eastern Europe countries, because in Eastern Europe countries there is a don't have any clue what board really exists.
Right. So what's that book?
Administration. I don't remember the author, but the name of the title of the book, Administration. It's not a big book.
ITS,
yeah, that's the people connected in that case. We use it as a kind of training tool for our book, just to in general introduce what's the kind of board member responsibility, what's the responsibility for chairman, and there is almost 10 kind of titles.
That's interesting. I I'm speaking totally out of ignorance, and I would appreciate your input just on this but under, you know, the communist regime, I would assume that there were no boards for anything. Would that be correct? Or, I mean, that weren't run by, at least by the party, or.
There is kind of, yeah, sorry. Because there was kind of type of boards, but it's usually it's what is being kind of run by one man, and just it's set up by gentlemen by one man, and it's kind of it's a way how the country is being run. It's the same as the board is being run.
Right.
So it's just called your pyramid, yeah.
Pyramid. Right. Well, you know, Neglachev's, I don't know if you heard it in the leadership forum, but or the network, but he talked about leadership in Eastern Europe and Western Europe and so forth. I thought his insights were very, very interesting. But the one statement that he made that just kind of resonated around in my head for a while was the fact that, in my country, he was speaking of Bulgaria, he says people, you know, actually... what was the word that he used? They prefer anarchy because there is a generation that preferred anarchy because they've just grown up into a situation where everybody told them what to do, and we kind of like that, and so
reaction.
What's that?
It's a reaction like a pressed print.
Uh-huh. Oh yeah, right.
Exactly on the opposite. So after so many years of summer,
right.
We keep with the control and so on. And now it's a reaction. Now it's anarchy. It's a kind of reaction of that control.
Well, and I think what that has created, at least in Eastern Europe, and probably and that's where the majority of you are coming from. Is that training people to be board members is something that's just totally foreign to them. This is the whole concept is kind of new, practically speaking, and so you're introducing a concept where we are responsible, we are taking the leadership for something, and what really that means, because that's not something that typically this generation or a generation has been used to doing. So I think Wolfgang, you make a very, very good point. And that is, is there something out there that just talks about in the most general ways, what the responsibilities of a board are? And that's a really insightful observation, which I frankly thank you for doing it, because that one flew over my head when you said that at first. And no, Jerry, you've got to go down a couple of notches here.
I know several examples where I think the board basically is made up of friends of the director.
Yeah.
So he chose for a beginning at least, and they are not controlled.
Essentially, they're a rubber stamp, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
They are listening to what his ideas are, and they say, great, Yeah. And like in one case, I don't know the law of the country, but the director is the board chairman. And to me, that doesn't make sense because what is the boss of the. So how can they ever fire him or whatever if he does something wrong? But he says, that's required by law. So to find somebody in that country that knows the law better than things like that, So that's I'm sure you don't find a book in America about that.
Well, I think that book is probably needed in America because I think, despite our our quote unquote perceived perceptions as it relates to, how smart we are, the realities are, I think probably there's still a majority of board members that serve, especially with nonprofits, who have no idea how to lead. The whole concept of leadership is something that is foreign to them, especially as it relates to an organization. But a lot of those people are well-intentioned. We love them. They love the organization. We kind of bring them on because, wouldn't this person be a great board member? Well, they're not necessarily great board members. But I don't think great board members are born any more than a lot of leaders are born. It's really something that we have to learn how to do. And I don't think it's impossible to learn, but it's certainly something that's important for us to learn.
I think when I said before that most board members don't have time because, we want quality people. Well, quality people usually are already on the team.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's very difficult. And so the ones that are on many boards, they are not because they don't have much to offer. So that's the dilemma. I think one way around is to grow your board members. You find some young people that are not involved in all kinds of things yet, but have the potential. So they don't have much to offer yet,
right,
but they have the potential.
Well, and give them, and I think that's a good testing ground, is to bring them into situations where you can observe them and you can give them a level of responsibility that not necessarily is, you know, giving them the farm to run at this particular point, but certainly giving them the opportunity to be able to demonstrate leadership skills and so forth.
Join 20 other boards afterwards.
Right.
So we actually started to do this many years ago. We started with kind of more pastors in the board and other kind of important people, and we find out that their engagement really is kind of zero because they're so busy. There's a meeting in other boards, and then I said, I give up. I don't need the board for board in a way. And then we start to kind of engage the graduates and kind of to teach them and train them. But the hardest thing I find out, it's new for me, it's new for them. It would be great if somebody who would be more experienced would come and give some kind of training and give some kind of model how to do it. That we, in our country, we have a lot, kind of opportunity.
Mm-hmm. There's a tension here, isn't it, the people you want to get, whether they're people who are very busy or not busy. I've had people on committees before who are not very busy and they've got time to give, and then you realise why they had time to give, why they're not busy.
Yeah.
Whereas mm-hmm. busy people, they organise themselves, they achieve a lot.
That's such a good point. It really is. Yeah, you know, busy people are generally the most productive people because they've learned how to manage their time. They know, I mean, I know how busy you are and all the things that you do, but you know, if there's going to be a meeting at UCCF, Peter's going to be there. And somehow he's figured out a way to make that happen, and I think that's, you know, that's commendable. So if you've got a busy person that's prepared to take the position, then you probably have got a, that's an excellent point. Yes?
You have really big experience towards different boards of different organizations. Like, short description, really good about it. Can you give?
Well, I think obviously a really good board, you know, starts with clearly understanding the mission of the organization and really believing in that mission. And, you know, somebody who obviously shares your values, I mean, I would think it would go as a foregone conclusion that these people would know Christ and know the Lord and be committed, you know, to, you know, furthering the cause of the kingdom of God through their participation in your board. I would think that in an ideal board you have diversity, you know, where you basically have strengths in areas where your ministry needs strength in governance, administration, and then in just the expertise in relationship to certain areas that are relevant to your mission. For example, education or whatever your mission is, that basically you have people that have expertise in that area. I think the perfect board has activities outside the boardroom. In other words, that, you know, there's as much activity that takes place outside the boardroom as takes within the boardroom. In fact, there's probably more activity. You know, that they have assignments, that, you know, those roles are basically being fulfilled in committee or in subcommittee or with task forces and so forth, but they have some level of activity outside the board. I see the perfect board meeting being, you know, a series of reports, you know, based upon study that's taken place outside the boardroom, where people are essentially evaluating work that has been done by people who've given it a lot of thoughtful and prayerful consideration, and that we can act on those. I think the perfect board probably doesn't meet on a monthly basis, but it might meet, you know, on a quarterly basis, if in fact you can organize the board in such a way that monthly meetings aren't required. It's not because, I mean, the frequency of meetings is not really the issue. It's the productivity of those meetings in moving the organization forward. I think the perfect board clearly knows what its agenda is for any given year. In other words, we set an agenda for the year. These are the things that we're going to do, but that agenda is set in light of the longer term of where it is that we're going as an organization. We had this conversation at lunch, and I know you would have appreciated this one, but, you know, UCCF as an organization, there's probably a capital funding campaign coming up within the next 2 or 3 years. Well, the time to think about that is now, and making sure that we have everything in place so that when that opportunity is launched to generate, you know, these additional incomes that are going to be required, then essentially, you know, we're going to be ready for that, and we're not going to, you know, have to, you know, build infrastructure to support what it is that we're doing when in reality that infrastructure has been built over the previous, you know, years that have come before the campaign, the launch of the campaign itself, which means that the board's got to think beyond, you know, the next meeting. In other words, they've got to have an agenda that goes out in terms of the future so that they can really set their schedule. It seems to me that there ought to be an agenda set, you know, just like you set a developmental agenda based upon where it is that you're going, that the board agenda, to build, what it is that it has the responsibility for guiding, that their agenda is driven by the same vision. But, that's the perfect board. I mean, ideally, I love to go into board meetings where we pray. We do the things that we, I think it's appropriate, given the nature of our ministries, that's how we ought to begin a meeting. But it seems to me that meeting, just goes. Here's what it is we're here for. We know what it is we're here for. The agenda has been received before the meeting, not at the meeting. Everybody knows exactly what it is that's going to be dealt with. These are the decisions that we're going to need to be making. If, in fact, some of these decisions are of such a momentous nature that we feel like, all of us should be fasting or praying or whatever as it relates to these very, very significant decisions that are going to direct the ministry, that they're instructed to do that before they arrive. That would be my general overview of the perfect board, and people that you can have a relationship with. I don't know. I think all of us need accountability. And I don't know how you structure accountability between the board and the chief executive officer. But it seems to me that accountability ought to be pretty clear. I have an accountability partner. I meet with my accountability partner once a month, And we set the rules for our relationship at the very beginning. We actually signed a covenant together. Here's what it is that we're agreeing to do. And there were certain things that we agreed to do. And it was clear, there are certain questions that I'm going to ask you that you must answer. And so just be prepared for that, because I don't want to, and he didn't want to feel embarrassed by asking those questions in terms of, well, what have you watched on television when you go to a hotel room? Well, I mean, that's, I ought to be asked that question, as anyone that travels. What did you do with your spare time? Because I travel and he travels, and we know the temptations that come to those who travel. And you know that, and if you don't know that, then you're naive, because the realities are they do exist. And so there are questions that we ask, and we agree to ask, and we agree to answer honestly, realizing that that's safe information. But it's information that only, my accountability partner and I know. And it seems to me that same kind of, somehow, we probably need to have, some level of accountability, between the executive director and the board, and maybe it's with the board chairman. And I don't know what. I know you have a very close relationship with Richard, and I don't know if it's ever broached the issues of accountability in terms of spiritual accountability. But it seems to me that would be appropriate, and I don't think it would be necessarily So, yes.
I have another question. What do you think about the two-level board, like a board of advisory and a governing board?
No, I'm fully in favor of those kinds of things. And I think the board of advisory or the advisory board could be, kind of the place where people start, where we have the opportunity of observing and interviewing and talking and learning about people. Because I think it does represent a good place to be able to select board members from, kind of the pool, kind of the pre. And I think, a lot of churches do that. I don't know what your church governance system is, but in our church we have, deacons and elders, and usually all of the elders come through the deacon pool, because we can see them function and working within the context of serving. And it's kind of interesting, isn't it, that the deacons serve and the elders lead. Well, I think the best leaders are people that have been the best servers. And I was thinking, if the leadership network has given me opportunity to kind of think through, because we've talked a lot about leadership. And I was reading about Peter this morning. I've been reading just the Passion of Christ this week in my devotions, and kind of reading it through in all the Gospels, But it's almost like Jesus is grooming, the disciples to be leaders. And there comes I think at the Passion of Christ on that last week, there's kind of a transitional place, time coming. Now I'm going to be leaving and you're going to be staying. And so, the following, the discipling that I have done is now turning you into a point where you're going to be a leader. But there's an interesting passage in Luke, when Jesus was going to Annas and Caiaphas' house, and Peter followed at a safe distance. And then, you know, he denied Christ the three times. And while that was a part of the leadership training, you know, it's kind of interesting if you look at it as a part of a process that Jesus had in mind for the leadership training of Peter. I'm sure that that one single event in Peter's life was something that he never forgot. But I think it was probably an important part of the process. So I think, you know, allowing people to fail and being able to come alongside them in the midst of their failure in a controlled situation, which maybe an advisory board capacity could provide, could be the best training for leaders. But I think good leaders have proven themselves to be good followers, to be submissive. And that's, you know, unfortunately, you know, there's any number of leadership books out there. I think some of the, probably the most insightful stuff that I've read on leadership is probably came out of the book, Jim Collins' book, Good to Great. And I don't know if you've read the book, but it's a marvelous book. Good to Great. And it basically talks about organizations, you know, that were evaluated over a 15-year period of time. That's what makes it such a fascinating book. Basically, a research team spent like, you know, 5 years looking at organizations who over a 15-year period of time started out at the same place, kept the same CEO for 15 years, okay? So, you know, basically when they looked at all the pool that they had to, you know, choose from and had gone from a level of, you know, success, they were good companies, but they became great companies. And they identified after they took the whole pool, which was all the, you know, companies that were listed on the National Stock Exchange and so forth, they came up with 13 companies. That's all they could find. And then they gave another company where they paralleled one company with the other that basically started at the same place when their study began. In other words, their revenues were similar, they were making the same amount of money and so forth. But one kind of left the pack and the other one, you know, didn't. You know, they just basically maintain, you know, they're a good company, but they weren't a great company. Well, one of the things that was discovered, which is the most fascinating of all the things from my standpoint, is that the leaders of the great companies were unpretentious. They were humble. They were totally surprised when they were being interviewed. To a man, they were totally surprised that they were even being singled out as being special. When they talked about their great company, they said, well, you know, this is why our company's great. We've got you and Victor and, you know, Wolfgang. I mean, that's why we're great. And they couldn't even, they were just amazed. But the people that you would often think of as the most successful leaders, the charismatics, Jack Welch and Lee Iacocca in our country, you know, who basically are, you know, charismatic figures who are vocal and very, very present, you know, they're not known as being sustained successful in leadership. They make a splash, but they don't make a splash for long. It's a fascinating study on leadership. So if you really want to read a good book on leadership, buy the book Good to Great. And there's a lot of wonderful principles in that I think would be really helpful to the organization. Good to Great, and the author's name is Jim Collins, C-O-L-L-I-N-S. And he wrote another book that preceded that was called Built to Last. And they're really corporate, you know, books. You know, this isn't, you know, you're not going to find the book down at the table downstairs. But, you know, of all the books I've read on management, it is far and away the very, very, very best book that I've ever read. And it will provide you, and I probably should have said something about that earlier. I'm glad that you asked the question. I don't know even how the question was asked, it talks about leadership, too, in terms of what our responsibility is. You know, he talks about an analogy of, you know, a bus. And he says, you know, we need to get the right people on the bus and in the right seats on the bus. And then essentially the bus is what it is that's going to take us to the fulfillment of the mission. He talks about all of that. And it's a book that probably should be read once a year. Honestly, it's such a good book. And no, it's not. No, it wouldn't be one that you'd expect to find down there, although I suspect that, you know, there's a majority of people that have been here that have read the book. Have any of you heard of it? Have you read it?
No.
You really must read it. Yeah. Honestly, it is a must read. I would never... There's a few things that I would say are a must read. Pardon me?
Good to Great or Built to Last? Or both?
good to great is the better one. Built to Last is equally as good. It involved as much research, but there's probably no book in history that has had as much research as this. I mean, they had a team of 20 people, you know, that worked for like 5 years on this project. And so it really is a pretty unbelievably deeply researched book. Have you read it? Oh, well, you should read it too. Okay, come with your evaluations. Pardon me?
We have books in the management.
Uh-huh. Oh, we do?